Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. And hey, this is right into this because I have a really important question to ask David French from National Review. Thanks for joining me, first of all, David.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So the most important pressing question is, you changed your avatar on Twitter to Ron Burgundy. Now,
yes.
As a huge Ron Burgundy fan, I applaud this. However, David French is Ron Burgundy. Explanations are needed.
Well, you know, my Twitter avatar, rather than typically being a picture of me, which is really not all that exciting, I tend to pay tribute to great historical figures. So previously, it was John Calvin. I'm PCA, Presbyterian, Calvinist Christian. So I had to give months-long shout out to John Calvin. And then, you know, I'm also in the journalism business, so why not pay tribute to the GOAT, the greatest of all time of journalism, Ron Burgundy?
So from John Calvin to Ron Burgundy, there's a trajectory there. Someone will write a history of Western civilization, and it will include this moment.
Well, it's just, you know, we have this constant battle. Well, maybe we as generous, I'm fighting this constant battle over the assertion that the two greatest comedic characters in modern film history are Ricky Bobby and Ron Burgundy. So wait for the Ron Burgundy avatar to go away at some point to be replaced by Ricky Bobby. So, and I don't know what that will say about the trajectory of Western civilization either.
So this does not reflect a life choice on your part that you're transitioning into like a new approach to these issues. Because I mean, look, Twitter is a stressful place to be. I mean, it is this constant dumpster fire, and we're all in there. And I'm pretty convinced that everybody on Twitter is having a nervous breakdown. So I'm concerned. I'm asking these questions.
Well, you know, let's not forget, Ron Burgundy's catchphrase, "You stay classy, San Diego." So it's a sort of my effort to urge Twitter to stay classy.
Well, there's the other thing, though, too, where he says, "Go bleep yourself, San Diego," which we're all like one step away from tweeting that out, right?
Well, you know, that's the Ron Burgundy. So there's Ron Burgundy, sort of the moral aspirationalist, urging his fellow citizens to be and remain classy. And then there's Ron Burgundy, the fearless truth teller. So, you know, like I said, he's the GOAT.
And he's kind of a big deal around here. So is that another one of your messages, though? You're saying, you know, that hey, on Twitter, David French, kind of a big deal around here. No?
My hot takes are so wonderful. They smell of rich mahogany.
Ooh, that is very, very good. Let's talk. You know, where to start here? Talk about socialism, year zero in conservatism. Our mutual friend Jeanine Pirro. By the way, that was sarcastic. You probably can't see that. All of those things. I did enjoy your subtweet of the Socialist Party, which put out what they said. Under socialism, you'll have no leaders. You will have no ruling class at all. And I think you commented, "Who's going to tell them?"
Well, you know, I've come to regret that tweet, because I don't know if you've ever gotten into a Twitter conversation or had your timeline hijacked by the actual Socialist Party, because they responded to
what
me.
Fresh hell!
Oh. They've responded to me, and they have not stopped responding to every single person, it seems, who has replied to that tweet. And, you know, every 3 seconds I'm getting a notification from the Socialist Party. And I normally don't like to mute or block absent abuse, but it's those guys are – I'm beginning to see why they punch above their weight on Twitter. They just never stop.
Really, the socialists. You see, I had this image when I was reading that tweet of like the old guy in kind of the holy sweater and kind of his, you know, graying scraggly hair in a bookstore where he's buying the latest, you know, Herbert Marcuse pamphlet. No stereotyping going on here, though.
No, none. No, it's totally different now. I don't know if you read the New York Magazine profile of the socialist scene in Brooklyn. It was actually a really fun piece of journalism to read. And it struck me as pretty, you know, having a whole lot of interesting parallels to sort of new, the enthusiasms of fresh religious movements.
Well, it is very much like that. I see that you probably saw earlier this week that Milwaukee was named to be the DNC convention headquarters.
Yes.
And I was waiting to see how long it would be before people noticed that, you know, we used to have socialist mayors in Milwaukee. In fact, we had three socialist mayors. And the amazing thing about them is they were nothing like AOC at all. They were actually kind of dour, boring, not terribly divisive. They were competent. The socialism in Milwaukee was sort of sewer socialism.
Mm. So, well, you know, there's an interesting contrast between Bernie and, say, AOC as well, even though I believe AOC was an enthusiastic Bernie supporter in 2016. And that is, you know, Bernie, until the more modern incarnation of him, was not exactly an identity politics guy. He was sort of the classic union economic nationalist sort of socialist who had a lot of things to say about immigration that are kind of out of step with the Democratic Party right now. And, you know, it's very interesting to watch the fight going on right now on progressive Twitter over whether Bernie is sufficiently dedicated to intersectionality and identity politics to be the standard bearer. And I was listening to David Leonhardt on The Argument, which is, you know, this New York Times podcast with Ross Douthat and David and Michelle Goldberg. And he was saying that the interesting thing about Bernie, which I thought this was an intriguing point, is that his de-emphasis on cultural issues, on culture war issues, and his greater emphasis on economic issues seems to be where more Americans are, but at the same time out of step with more where the Democratic Party activist base is.
I've been resisting much punditry on the Democratic field since there's whatever about 86 candidates out there, and we're at that stage which will last about 5 minutes. People going, "Hey, Mayor Pete is the coolest thing out there," which will be succeeded by, you know, "Beto is the future of the party," and that will be succeeded by who knows what. So before we get into some of the other stuff, you wrote a column. Actually, you and I wrote very similar columns this week. Mine was completely derivative of yours. It was basically built off some tweets, which is this thing that we're experiencing on the right, where history has been erased. That conservatives never won anything at all until Donald Trump came along. That you just had these low testosterone cuck losers who never had a single victory. And that the election of Donald Trump is year zero, and that all of the fighting and all of the successes come after this. And you put out a tweet, which then I turned into a column, and then you turned it into a column as well, just reminding people, like, okay, guys, you know, we didn't just fall off the turnip truck here. Conservatives have actually been fighting and winning things for some time.
Yeah, changing the country in better way. This is something that has driven me nuts, because you will see time and time again, it's a really pretty common rationalization for the support for Trump, which is sort of goes like this: in desperation, because we never win anything, and because we are losing everywhere, we turn to the guy who will finally fight. And that is not a caricature of the position of a number of sort of pro-Trump voices. It is the position of a number of pro-Trump voices. And it's so ahistorical. I mean, I broke it down by significant categories. And the ancillary to that is the Republicans didn't know how to stand up to Barack Obama. They just rolled over to Barack Obama. And if you look in areas from life to gun rights, to education, to foreign policy, to economic policy, to the thwarting the many, many legislative initiatives that Obama would have passed but for a Republican opposition, it's just fake news to say the Republicans and conservatives didn't know how to win. I mean, even if you go electorally, I think it seems as if the entire argument about Republicans not knowing how to win electorally really boils down to the 2012 presidential election.
Right.
I mean, that's the point where people's you know, it sort of broke people's minds in a bit. But let's even fast forward to 2014. By 2014, the Democrats across the country were at close to a 100-year low in their representation in elected office. I mean, you know, just as sort of the 2012 loss in a lot of people's minds just sort of was doom, there was also doom that the Democrats were feeling, that the Obama administration and the unpopularity of a lot of these policies had sort of broken the Democrats nationally. And so this idea that, you know, there was nothing but electoral defeat and that there were no victories for life or liberty or you name it until Trump is just fiction.
You know, but it's a fascinating phenomenon. You know, you go back to 2010, the sweeping victories that that were experienced then. But then what you found was this outrage industry that really had created a vested interest in convincing conservatives that they had been betrayed, that they weren't pushing hard enough, that rallied around promises that could not be fulfilled, that you would make these grandiose projections of what would happen. They were never going to happen. And then when they didn't, you had an entire industry crop up and raised money and, you know, pumped ratings, got email lists, convincing people that we just needed to fight more.
Right.
And so that was in a lot of ways, I mean, this whole sense of defeat was created by the unrealistic expectations and then by the exploitation of the inevitable failures.
Well, yeah, I think there's so much truth to that. And part of this is political operatives very cynically preyed on civic ignorance. So, you know, you had congressmen running on repealing Obamacare. Mm-hmm. As if they could do it without a veto-proof majority, you know. But we're talking about a public that if you ask them to explain the veto process, majority people just really can't do it. And so here you have people spending advertising dollars, doing mass mailings, doing, you know, media as much as they can, talking about how they're going to repeal Obamacare, when everybody knows that it takes a lot more than just flipping the House. It even takes more than flipping the Senate. And you know, when it comes to substantive legislation, you're even then talking about, in many cases, you're talking about filibuster-proof majorities. And so this was an enormous enterprise to try to reverse Obamacare. And what was even a little bit more, even more cynical about it is there was all these people campaigning about reversing Obamacare and no consensus around any other plan.
No kidding.
There was and my colleague Ramesh Panuru said something I thought really, really insightful. And he said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, so Ramesh, if I butcher this, please correct me. But Republicans are pretty good at tax policy because we think about it a ton. We have a lot of expertise. We have a lot of plans that we can move to and go to. We have less expertise in healthcare. Mm-hmm. We have less, fewer of our best and brightest minds are dealing with healthcare, which is sort of the inverse of the Democrats. And so the fact of the matter is everyone is talking about repealing Obamacare, and there was not nearly as much thought, not nearly as much energy and effort given to what would come next, which is, of course, the very question you have to grapple with when you're talking about repeal.
You ought to think so. Let's talk about abortion, because this is another one of those areas where if you went to CPAC, and I'm glad to talk about that a little bit later, you would get the sense that the legacy of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush was being completely erased as if they had done nothing whatsoever. And in fact, there was major progress from the right to life point of view in those presidencies. The legislation they passed, the judges that they appointed, and also the larger cultural project of changing hearts and minds,
yes,
which I think is one of the extraordinary stories of the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes, I mean, that is, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think if you had taken someone on the left in 1974, say, you know, right around the time, right after Roe is decided, and asked them to predict what would the state of our culture be in 40 plus years, will this have been a settled issue? you know, will this be something that the fights over Roe will be viewed as something that, you know, thoroughly in the rearview mirror? And I, you know, in an arc of history, progressive would have said, yeah, this is over. You know, we won. We're, you know, it's a mop up operation. For crying out loud, the Southern Baptist Convention in the 1970s supported abortion rights. But in fact, the opposite has happened. America has become more pro-life, not just by some poll measures, but by actual policy and practice. So the abortion rate right now is lower than it was at the time of Roe, and it is less than half of what it was at its peak. And that means not just hundreds of thousands of lives saved, but millions of lives saved. That is an untold success. And then for those who say, well, Trump is the most pro-life president in American history. Well, I mean, George W. Bush signed the 2002 Born Alive Act. He signed the 2003 partial birth abortion ban. He had 330 judges nominated and confirmed, almost uniformly pro-life judges, and two Supreme Court justices who have excellent records on life. And so, you know, that's not nothing. And we cannot act as if the pro-life movement was on some sort of political life support until 2016. And even going at the state level, more than one quarter of all pro-life laws enacted at the state level since Roe were enacted in the last 5 years of Obama's presidency. That's amazing.
It is amazing. And I just want to underline one of the points, because I used to work very closely with Wisconsin Right to Life. And one of the things that they did, they always had a legislative agenda, but I think their real triumph was an ad campaign aimed at young women, just basically saying, we're here for you, make the choice of life. And as they ran these things, they noticed you could trace the decline in the number of abortions. And again, this is not anti-choice or pro-choice. This was like, hey, make this particular choice. And it was a hearts and minds campaign, which goes back to, and I think you and I discussed this last time you were on the podcast, because I know there are many people who are willing to swallow a lot of things with Donald Trump because of this one issue. And I certainly understand that argument. But then there is the flip side that if the abortion right to life issue is going to be decided by hearts and minds and in the culture, you know, there are other threats than simply legislative action, including what happens when that movement, that cause, becomes irredeemably attached to Trumpism.
Right.
And I wish there was as much concern about that as there is about some tweeting that you may have heard went on at CPAC.
There was a tweet controversy at CPAC?
There's rumors of it. I have no such thing.
So this is a really, really important point for the pro-life movement to ponder. And that is, you know, we often think of the pro-life, the battle for life is boiled down to three words, Roe versus Wade, that the sum total of the battle for life is the reversal of Roe or the limitation of Roe, the restriction of Roe. When the fact of the matter is, you could reverse Roe tomorrow, you know, have the five right-leaning judges, the five originalist judges just decide they've had enough. Next major abortion case they hear, they're going to reverse Roe. And it would not result in the abolition of abortion in the United States. And in fact, if you lose the cultural battle, even in a post-Roe America, you could have actually a more liberal abortion regime. Like, for example, just ask the state of New York after what it just passed. And so there is no way to deal with the abortion culture without winning the larger cultural argument in the United States. And I have said this until I'm blue in the face, that people need to understand that bad people can harm good causes. I mean, this is sort of, you know, culture 101. And one of the things that I think is particularly harmful in the abortion context is that libertinism is incompatible with a culture of life. And Trump is a symbol of libertinism. And I think that that is a real problem in the long term. Look, I'm grateful for the good things he does.
Yeah.
I'm not scorning that at all. I'm just saying this enthusiasm for him as sort of the standard bearer, as one pro-life activist told me on the phone not long ago, as the greatest pro-life president America has ever seen. No, I'm going to have to respectfully dissent on that, because I'm not quite sure that he's going to have the cultural effect over the long term that people want.
Yeah, I wonder whether people do think in terms of the long term. You mentioned what we thought the world was going to look like in the 1970s. And I remember actually, you know, thinking that it was probably going to be inevitable that society was going to embrace the abortion culture, and they have not. But that's a 40-year project. So 40 years, let's look ahead for 40 years. What does the future hold? Not just the next election or the next court decision, but 40 years from now. You know, are we running the risk of discrediting the movement? And I think that's a legitimate point. All right, let's jump into some other things. I think you and I were discussing this right before we went. We started taping. I think we need to have like a summit meeting where we all decide what the statute of limitations is on stuff that we have written or said in the past. I'm willing to throw out, just for the sake of argument, 20 years. You know, but I'm open to 15, and I'm obviously thinking about this for a variety of reasons. Joe Biden's going to have to answer for things he said 40 years ago about school busing. Yep. You know, back in the 1970s, I think everybody should be able to change their mind, even Joe Biden. And then Tucker Carlson is being hammered by hammered for some comments he made back in 2006, which I think is right on the cusp of where I might draw the line. So. Your thoughts, David, on going back and shaming people for naughty things they might have said in the past.
Let me put it this way. I am weary of that entire approach and that entire culture. This idea – so, you know, I mean, this isn't – by this point, and for those who've not followed, Tucker Carlson had apparently a regular call-in slot where he'd call in to Bubba the Love Sponge. Now – let's just, you know, here's free advice for young listeners. Yeah. Don't take a offer to be a regular on a Shock Jocks radio show.
Yeah.
You're just asking for trouble. But anyway,
yeah. The Love Sponge thing should have been like kind of a warning, just a red flag.
it should be.
Yeah. But, plus the Bubba.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, look, what is going on here is a really bad faith enterprise, which goes something like this. For whoever's doing it, and Media Matters for America on the left is probably the principal, one of the principal practitioners of this. But it's essentially to say, okay, if I don't like you, David French, let's say you're getting more prominent than I would like, your conservatism really annoys me, I think conservatives are bad people. Instead of saying, hey, I'm going to rebut you on the merits of your arguments, and we're just going to have it out in the marketplace of ideas. You get a bunch of minions to go find anything and everything that I have ever said about virtually any topic. And then maybe somewhere I said something really dumb. Or maybe somewhere I said something not just dumb, but bad, evil. Now, let me ask you this. When these people find this, are tears rolling down their cheeks at the horror of what they've discovered?
This is shocking, yeah.
No, there's, you know, hi, we got him now. This is, I think, really destructive, really destructive. And
you're describing really what has become the norm of much of the debate that we have. That,
right.
That somebody, you know, dislikes something that you have said or done. And the goal is we have to discredit and destroy you in some way. And going back and finding something either you said or done, or the various times that you have, you know, taken food out of the office refrigerator without permission, things like that. But you're right. It is the antithesis of actually debating. OK, what do you say now? What are you believing? What is my counter argument? It's almost like that's so last century now.
Yeah, you know, and look, I mean, I think Tucker Carlson is bad for the conservative movement and is a negative voice in America. But, you know, I'm happy to write about that. I've written about that. I'm happy to argue about his populist views. I'm happy to argue about the way he runs his show, which, truth be told, his show contributes a lot to outrage culture as well. Let's have that conversation. But this idea that because I don't like Tucker, what I'm going to do, or I don't like, you know, I don't know Tucker, but I don't like his sort of public voice, what I'm going to then do is I'm going to look for the time bomb in his past so that I can find some way to blast him from the public square as a proxy for defeating him in the marketplace of
ideas.
That's
exactly right. That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my problem.
No, that's and that is exactly the formula. And again, I have real problems with Tucker Carlson. Some of the things he said about populism, which I disagree with strongly, the way he's run his show. And yet you can also still wince at what you're describing, this attempt to, you know, again, rather than debate him, engage him, you have to blow him up. OK, now, speaking of sort of the opposite end of that, without any sort of a statute of limitations, the back and forth over anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim hate, Jeanine Pirro at Fox. there are moments where you go, I mean, I honestly always try to think, what is the other person thinking? And usually you can figure out, okay, they're pressing this button because this will be effective and having this response. The Judge Jeanine thing, where she goes after Ilhan Omar, who is a legitimate target of criticism, and suggesting that because she wears a hijab that somehow she does not believe in the Constitution or is an American, was so stereotypically bigoted. I don't know who made the point. I just wonder, you know, who put it in the teleprompter? I mean, who actually, what editor, what producer saw this and thought, yeah, this is what we should go on the air with?
Yeah, there were some safeguards that failed there. This is not sort of Judge Jeanine. Well, so far as we know, it wasn't her just riffing off the cuff. But it's becoming increasingly clear to me, and this is something I've been talking about in a number of platforms, is I think we're in a position now where we sort of have two culture wars. One is the classic right-left culture war. My team wins, your team loses. Ilhan Omar is bad, I'm going to focus entirely on her. Or Judge Jeanine is bad, I'm going to focus entirely on her. This sort of classic left-right dichotomy centered around, you know, issues and people. And that's old news. That's been around for a while. But one that's becoming, I think, more and more prominent and increasingly important to our public life is the battle not just between right-left, but at what I would say between decency and indecency. In other words, as we pursue these ideological battles, how do we treat other human beings? Yeah. Do we protect the rights of others that we would like to exercise ourselves? Do we treat others the way that we would like to be treated? Do we provide the benefit of the doubt to opponents in the same way that we do to our friends? Do we, you know, these are kinds of questions that are sort of at the core level of civil society. And it's as if we're reaching a point that says, well, to beat Ilhan Omar, it's okay to become her in a way. It's okay to become, to do the dual loyalty thing. But the dual loyalty thing, I guess, is what, less offensive if it's applied against a Muslim? And so that's where we're headed, and you see it all the time in this fight fire with fire, make the other side live up to its own rules, you know, these little catchphrases you hear all the time. And that, I think, there is room for a coalition of people who say, you know, look, I really disagree with you, but in our disagreement, we will treat each other honorably. And because that is actually part of building civil society in a continent-sized, multi-ethnic, multi-faith democracy, is we got to have this level of baseline honor and respect. Otherwise, we'll tear ourselves apart in the elusive quest for permanent victory.
Well, to react, I mean, obviously, that's correct. What you're describing is civilization. I mean, it's what we developed as opposed to, you know, throwing poop at one another. But it also seems like, how do we unravel this? How do we turn this back? Because all of these trends, all of the incentives seem to be driving us in the wrong direction. You're right. I actually believe there is a coalition of the decent people who are willing to do that. But you don't see them a lot on Twitter. I mean, the voices that you are that are amplified are not the ones who are pushing us to treat one another with a certain amount of respect or deal with one another with an assumption of goodwill. Right. So, right. I mean, is it have we passed some tipping point, some point of no return where it's like you have behaved uncivilly or you have you've gone too far. Therefore, I will behave uncivilly and I'm going to go too far. Can I give you an example of what's going on right now that's making me think about this at a different level? It's almost changing the subject, but it's the same subject. So I had a piece today where I pointed out what a really bad idea it would be for the Democrats to embrace court packing the U.S. Supreme Court, pointing out the last time this awful idea came up, Franklin Roosevelt suffered a huge defeat at the hands of members of his own party because it was so bad. It is such a fundamental violation of norms. And for people who are expressed concern about norms, it's really off message. But the reaction that I'm getting from folks is like, oh, look, we need to do this because look what you Republicans have done with Merrick Garland. You people have packed the Supreme Court with conservatives. Therefore, there's absolutely nothing wrong with us packing it with liberals. And you just get that sense of how this spirals into more and more extreme policy positions where it is, you know, I win. And that means that you must be reduced to scorched earth.
Yes. Well, that's absolutely right. And both sides are laboring under this delusion, I think, that they're going to, that we're passing. And I think this is a really important thing to flesh out. And that is, I think both sides are laboring under a delusion that says we're going through this passing phase of contentious battle before I ultimately win and rout my enemies.
Right.
And rather than saying what I think is the realistic thing, which is we are setting ourselves up for permanent divisiveness. And how can we navigate that and stay together is, I think, going to be the critical question of the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, one of the things that I think is happening here is with the politicization of everything, the increasing religious divides in America, we're reaching a point where something called that Cass Sunstein articulated about 20 years ago called the law of group polarization is taking effect. And this is a super important phenomenon for people to understand. And what the law of group polarization and what this law.
This is going to depress me, isn't it?
Oh, it's really depressing. Just hold on to your hat.
Okay.
So essentially what it means is when people of like mind gather, the common expression of their shared view gets more extreme. So in other words, when you get together with a bunch of people who agree on an issue, you're usually going to end up being more extreme on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have is an increasingly walled off geographic culture. You know, the Big Sort, for example, where we now have entire cities with less ideological diversity than your average evangelical megachurch. And so what's happening is that people who are living in like-minded communities, who are walled away from friends or neighbors who may have opposing points of view, are congregating amongst themselves and sort of whipping each other into a frenzy. And you see the fruit of that on Twitter. Now, people cross-pollinate on Twitter mainly to snipe at each other. But what you're seeing is this phenomenon where the people who are most engaged in politics are walling themselves off, living in like-minded communities, and growing more extreme by the month almost.
Well, and it is interesting because the Big Sort documented how that was happening geographically and physically. And of course, the parallel is that we're walling ourselves off until in these alternative reality silos of media and tribal identity. And I do think that it causes the extremism in part because you don't have to ever engage with anyone with whom you disagree. So therefore, you can go on Twitter and see things like, the Democrats hate God. They hate America. They want to take away your hamburger. And people who actually never have to deal with anyone who disagrees with them think, yeah, this is how terrifying they are. And of course, there's the flip side that every Republican, you know, is racist who just simply wants to take away your health care and give it to the Koch brothers. And this is the kind of cartoon thinking that you'll get if you become hermetically sealed and you never have to engage in any meaningful way with anyone else's ideas or anyone else as a human being.
Yeah. And one of the things when I talk about this, I'll get immediate pushback from people say, are you kidding me? I see stuff from liberals all the time on Twitter. And my next question is it the best expression of the opposing point of view, or is what you're seeing called nut picking? So nut picking, I didn't come up with the term, I forget who did, but it's beautiful, is essentially this phenomenon that says, okay, I'm going to patrol through, say, progressive Twitter. I'm going to find the most outrageous expression of the opposing point of view and then tweet it out as emblematic of my opponent's thinking. Like, this is what they really think.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this constantly. You might have an entire thoughtful discussion on, say, the right or the left, in sort of an intramural thoughtful discussion on the right or the left about an issue. And then you've got some blue check mark celebrity or some blue check mark, you know, radio personality who says something just ridiculous. And it goes all over the place as, well, this is the proof of what they are really like. And you see that phenomenon all the time, and it misleads people into thinking that they're getting exposed to the other side's point of view.
Well, there's a whole industry devoted to that. I mean, that in fact has been, you know, absolutely weaponized on, obviously, I'm sorry to say, both sides.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, you know the term both sides, liberals just hate both sidesism because it's totally asymmetrical.
Right. Well, my colleague, Michael Brendan Daugherty, came up with this construct, which I think is just brilliant. He said, when you're a partisan and you encounter wrongdoing on your side, that's exceptional. When you encounter wrongdoing on the other side, that's emblematic. And so what ends up happening is you can get hit with an avalanche of evidence of crappy things people have done on your own side. But then you go, well, those are just isolated exceptions from the general rule that we're a whole bunch of really good people. And then you look at sort of a lineup of crappy evidence of behavior, of evidence of crappy behavior on the other side, and you say, see, it's typical. That's who they are.
That's true. And I mean, just human nature is that you're going to hold your friends, someone you know and you like, to a different standard than somebody you don't know and detest.
Right.
So, you know, part of the elaborate system of due process, of weighing of evidence, has been to counter what would essentially be more of a gut reaction that is really why we're wired that way.
Right. Right. We really are. I mean, that's why due process is one of the great inventions of modern civilization, is to channel bias and rage and anger and hurt and pain and all of these things through a neutral arbitrator, you know, a neutral adjudicator, applying specified rules of evidence and specified burdens of proof. It's not perfect. No human institution is perfect. But my goodness, the grotesque injustices it has prevented over the centuries.
So next year at CPAC, could we send you as our correspondent? I'm just spitballing here, man.
I don't consent to that assignment.
Yeah, it's like I don't think it could pay me enough money to go. Not to mention the fact that I kind of know what would happen if I went. But life is too short to ever go to CPAC. It'll be an adventure going to the Democratic Convention next year. That'll be enough for me.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is there are certain, you know, in these very fractious times, you know, one of the things that I try to do, look, I might disagree with this or that thing that my, you know, conservative friends have done, but when people are trying to operate in good faith and they're trying to figure out, you know, how to navigate these times, I mean, I think we can disagree about any given approach or tactic and still sort of maintain the fellowship of the miserable, so to speak, in trying to figure this all out. And you know, the CPAC thing is, you know, that you know, the interesting thing about the CPAC phenomenon is it is a place that has given itself over to a lot of the worst elements of the right,
yeah.
But in my view, has kind of clung on to one or two of the better elements of the right, and that's the pro-life movement, and you know, maybe a couple of other things. And so, how do you defend what's good there, while trying to reject the bad, or do you just reject the whole thing?
Yeah, that of course is always the dilemma with these sorts of things. But I like your phrase, the fellowship of the miserable. And so and David, as a fellow brother of the fellowship of the miserable, I appreciate you joining me today.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.